Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1455.1S1435, certificate number 42240. Saul Zaintz. Did I say that wrong, right? Is it like all the Zaints go marching in?
I think it's closer to Zaintz.
Saul Zaintz.
But it does have an A-E in there.
But it
which you would normally pronounce E, Zaintz.
But it rhymes with Saul Zaintz, makes me want to dance.
Well, yeah, that will come up later in the show.
Oh, he's going to make me want to dance?
Well, he may make you want to dance. There are dancing figures prominently in one small corner of this story.
Whether or not
Saul can or cannot dance.
I'm looking at a picture of him, and he looks like the little white-bearded teacher on Fame. Mm-hmm. And Fame makes me want to dance.
There you go.
So by the transitive property.
You have made the connection.
Saul Zaintz makes me want to dance.
He is he does look like a kindly little hobbit, doesn't
he's
he?
He's professorial. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Sweet-faced, round-faced person.
I just think a white beard on anyone makes them an authority.
Well, thank you.
That's why I believe everything you say.
Why you defer to me?
You told me I had mispronounced Saul Zaintz, and I was like, well, I don't have a beard, so I guess
you mispronounced Solvia, too. There are so many things we mispronounce. so today's show, you know, I've been very responsive to criticism that we're too pandering to Gen Z. And the millennials.
Too many millennial shows.
Too many shows about millennials that interest only millennials. And so I figured, well, what group is underrepresented in the topics, you know, the interest around topics?
What group never skewed American culture toward them and left it there forever?
Right. And so today's show is dedicated to the baby boom.
Finally, something for the baby boomers.
Yeah, a show that I think every boomer will identify with in some way or another.
They already, I mean, not maliciously, but in aggregate, kind of looted our entire Western socio-political system and then pulled the ladder up behind them. And now they get an omnibus about Saul Zaintz.
Yay, Saul Zaintz.
It's really the cherry on the sundae for them.
Mm-hmm. Saul Zaintz, of course, not a boomer.
Too old.
Saul Zaintz was my father's age, approximately. World War II, greatest generation.
Greatest.
And, you know, they laid the groundwork for the boomers to
They did all the hard work that let...
That's right.
That let the boomers be the last generation to own homes.
But we're going to... No, that's not true. You and I both
own
our homes.
I think we are the last... I think Gen X might be the last generation of homes. But we're just coasting. On boomer fumes.
Own my home 100% by accident. And you got yours because you were a computer programmer.
Mine's also by accident.
Yeah. Right,
I think.
Right.
I accidentally went on a game show.
Neither of us could own a home today if we were ourselves only 10 years younger.
If we were podcasters. Even if I was a computer programmer, it might be a little dicey. I think I'd be living out in Marysville or something.
I have friends all the time that come over to my house and go, God, I should have bought a house. I'm like, yeah, you should.
There was a time. There was a brief time.
Yeah. All that cocaine doesn't look so fun now, does it?
But the boomers' parents came home from war and they were like, hey, please give me $1,200 and 6 bags of flour and you can have...
Yeah.
This starter home in the suburbs.
Yeah, that's right. My mom, when my mom divorced our dad, not her dad, but my sisters and my dad, and moved back to Seattle, she bought a home, post-war, mid-century modern home, $12,000, I think. And that was at a time when, yeah, $12,000 was.
Yeah, to be fair, that would be a $100,000 home today.
Yeah, that's right. But it was something that she could afford. And even then, when a woman couldn't have a checking account, she managed to buy it.
She knew where the Confederate gold was hidden.
She did. She found, she carried her bag of gold around her neck.
Did she kidnap a little leprechaun that looked like Saul's aunt's?
No, she put $800 down and.
That was the thing. Yeah, you could put $800 a month down. Yeah. It's like getting a Dyson vacuum today, except you got a home in the suburbs.
Well, wait a minute. How did we start pandering to the millennials and Gen Z? All this banter is just for them. We're just trying to seem cool.
We're just trying to butter them up. Hey, you guys like TikTok, right? Yeah. You know who I love? Lizzo.
Guess what? You guys don't get to own your own homes. Neener, neener, neener. That's my attitude now.
But they get sad Phoebe Bridgers songs about it.
Yeah, they do. They do. And they get to be mad about it on the internet, which is what...
That's its own reward.
Yeah, we didn't get to do that when we were kids.
What would you rather have? A nice 3-bedroom house or to be bitter online? They're both equally good.
They kind of do.
They both keep you dry in a way.
Yeah, they stroke the same little part of your duodenum.
Probably not your duodenum.
Emotional duodenum.
Now, do you think the duodenum's in the brain? Yes or no?
No.
Oh, that is correct.
It tickles.
It can tickle if you've eaten, you've had too much Indian food, I guess.
Speaking of too much Indian food.
Oh, is this actually going to be a segue?
No, absolutely not. There's no, Indian food does not figure in this story at all. Although I bet if you went back.
I bet over a curry somewhere in the West End, Saul Sands was having lunch one day with Michael Douglas.
If you sat everybody involved in this story down and said, does Indian food appear at any point? It has to have.
It has to have.
Right? At some point.
Saul Sands, from the kind of movies I know he made, he must have seen Gandhi. And maybe he got a little peckish after and was like, I'm going to go for Indian. I'm going to have a curry.
We played a little game earlier today where I said, name the films that Saul Zance was involved in. And you threw Gandhi out.
You were saying, what are his best pictures? You say Gandhi?
I was just repeating you. Didn't you just say Gandhi?
Do you say Mahatma?
No. Gandhi.
Is it because I said Mahatma? Saul Zance?
I don't know.
Yeah, you said he won 3 Best Picture Oscars.
Yes.
And I was like, yeah, Cuckoo's Nest and Return of the King. And you said, no, not Return of the King.
Nope.
And I said, Gandhi. I did not say Gandhi. And you said, no. And I still don't know what the other two are.
You threw out a couple of other options.
Deer Hunter.
Both of them good. No, not Deer Hunter.
What did I say? Oh, I said Out of Africa. It's not Out of Africa?
Nope. And it's not. And you also guessed, Chariots of Fire.
Yeah.
Not that either.
Not Kramer versus Kramer.
Well, let's get there. Let's get there by a long path instead of a short path.
I'm still thinking.
All right.
I'm allowed to. I don't know. You talk.
It's great radio to watch a guy think.
No, what will happen is you'll tell the story of Saul Zance, and part of my brain will be churning away on Best Picture winners of the 70s
okay,
and 80s.
Good. Make it not the part that then responds to the things I say and engages in banter with me.
You're going to ask a question, and I'll just be like.
You'll be like, uh-huh, what? Make it the part that's normally playing a video game.
Platoon. part of my brain that's normally doing Spelling Bee, New York Times Spelling Bee right now.
That's right.
Will instead be thinking of...
Best Picture.
Big, Oscars. Splashy, possibly haven't aged well, Best Picture winners.
I think we'll agree, although you have film opinions that...
I got film opinions.
You got film opinions, and I don't carry around so many film opinions. I have some.
In your duodenum.
But I do have a lot of opinions about American music and American, the story, the American music story.
Is this a Johnny Cash album?
It's the American music story starring Johnny Cash.
An 80-year-old Johnny Cash, produced by Rick Rubin.
Cash is no longer with us.
No, and he didn't live to be 80, I believe. I went to the Johnny Cash Museum in Nashville a couple weeks ago.
And?
It's amazing. You can see his report card.
Wait, is that the one where they took the little cabin he was born and actually reassembled it in a museum?
Well, that was, yeah. So for many years, you could go to that little Johnny Cash house out on the highway somewhere. It was in disrepair by the time Rick Rubin shot the Hurt video. Or not Rick, who shot that? Probably Mark Romanek of, you've probably seen him on that Beatles, Maria Semple's Beatles Zoom.
Oh, right.
But now I think they've taken a lot of the stuff from there and put it in this museum right in the tourist core of downtown Nashville, right by the Country Music Hall of Fame, right next to a place called
one of the most beautifully preserved American cities, Nashville, where the entire downtown core is exactly as it was in 1870.
That's not how it struck me at all.
No.
It looked like the whole downtown core was maybe one convention center.
Yeah, there's like six buildings in the whole city that survived the multiple attacks.
I recommend the Johnny Cash Museum. There's you can see he was a very good typist. You can see he was the radio operator at the end of after serving in post-World War II Berlin, that first got word in wherever he was there, the early 50s, that Stalin had died. Johnny Cash possibly knew before any other American that Stalin had died, and he ran to tell his NCO.
Can you confirm that he ran?
Yeah. He was like, I'm Johnny Cash, and I'm going to run over here.
Let me tell you. Corporal?
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash, and Joseph Stalin's dead. He appended, hello, I'm Johnny Cash, to everything.
Yeah.
He said he was ready to do a variety show, even in 1951.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash. The accent wasn't good, but the timbre. You know, I did a Christmas album once.
As Johnny Cash.
Well, there is one song that I was cosplaying as Johnny Cash. It's called Christmas in Jail. And I think you can find it if you're listening. If you're looking for me doing a Johnny Cash impression, try and find my number one smash indie pop Christmas hit, Christmas in Jail.
I think my tourist impressions of Nashville are getting pretty far afield from Saul Zance's music career.
Yeah, it doesn't have much of a Nashville overlap. It starts.
What was his music interest?
Well, wow, you're really trying to pull me along here because you want to do shows that are less than an hour and a half long.
No, I just regret getting onto the contents of the Johnny Cash Museum because I feel like we were already one step removed from Saul Zance at that point.
Yeah, right. Well, that's typical of us. No, we're going to start our show in that era, the immediate post-war era, in the kind of the formation of those early jazz records and the jazz labels that kind of defined that the collision of New York record business, a lot of Jewish guys coming out of the war with an interest in jazz in Chicago and New York, forming small labels, putting out vinyl sides. There was a proliferation of jazz-oriented record companies that often only put out a few artists, only stayed alive for a little while, but were very influential and established what we think of as the record business.
The big, like Columbia Records, those big record companies just started out as New York guys releasing popular jazz tunes.
Well, Columbia is an example of a record label that goes all the way back to the very invention of recorded music.
They're putting out wax cylinders.
Wax cylinders and music on wire. And then they were acquired by a small little company called CBS in the era right before the war. So they're an example of, the big industry. We're talking about laid the groundwork for indie rock.
Little mediums, little single guys.
Yeah.
Finding.
Or sometimes a pair of brothers or this guy, that guy.
I only know this from musician biopics.
Yeah.
Where, there's always one old white guy in the cast, middle-aged white guy, so you get your Stanley Tucci or your Richard Schiff or your, to play the guy who's in New York and is like, I like your sound, Aretha, Stevie, Ray, boys, I'm going to make you all.
Stevie Ray, boys.
Well, he's always, whoever it is.
Yeah, the Stevie Ray boys. They were amazing duo.
Whoever the star is, and in these movies, these biopics often have like a largely African American cast, and then there's one kind of middle aged guy who's like, "I understand your sound, and I'm going to make you into Ray Charles."
There are a few different versions of that story, right? There's the country western version, the Sun Records version, where there's a guy sitting behind a console who's like,
"Sam Phillips,
hey man, you sound good. Come on in and play that guitar."
Do those, maybe do more of those rockabilly songs.
Yeah, heck a slammin'. Get your thing on and put your spats on.
Do you think Sam Phillips ever said heck a slammin'?
I don't think they wore spats either. But then there's the Motown version.
Yeah.
There's the Los Angeles version. There's the, there's the real swamp version. And then there's the Chicago, the Chess Records. And the New York version that often came out of Brill Building songwriting universe. And we think about that story, and it always, as you were saying, always has a component where the record label is a little shady, or there's a deal that doesn't suit the musician, that doesn't favor the musician.
Yeah, you do feel like maybe the artists are actually being used.
Yeah, the whole story of the American music business, I think if you were a layperson with an interest in the music business, you could be forgiven for feeling like every label was a ripoff, every deal was a scam. And particularly that story gets told as an example of institutionalized racism a lot.
Yeah.
Right? The African-American artist is always kind of, you know, finagled out of their rightful royalties. But
you just want to go back in time and be like, keep your publishing, Smokey Robinson.
But the problem is the Beatles tell that story about themselves.
Right.
Right? There's no band, no artist, doesn't matter how huge they are.
It's basically prejudice against the young who are dumb.
And as somebody who was offered a few recording contracts in my life, the first ones I looked at looked pretty scammy. And I, at the time, I had read all those biopics and watched all those books. And so I was very nervous. I was very, I thought I was pretty wise. And at the time, Steve Albini was early days blogging a lot about how the music industry was just a ripoff fest. And it caused me to make some dumb choices. And one of those was I was offered my first recording contract that was legitimate came from Sub Pop.
Hmm.
And they offered me a deal, a 4-record deal with options for more. And I had wonderful meetings with them downtown with Jonathan Poneman specifically. We really liked each other. He was like, your band is great. Let's get this happening. And I had no less than Steve Albini at one remove whispering in my ear going, oh, it's all a scam.
Steve Albini appears on your shoulder.
He did. It's all a scam.
And on
man.
The other shoulder, it's like Ahmet Erdogan. No, take the deal.
Take the deal.
Boys, I'm going to make you famous.
And I heard from a lot of people like, yeah, okay, maybe it is a scam financially at one level, but you're going to be on Sub Pop. You'll be a Sub Pop band. At some point, it kind of doesn't matter if you're not making music, if you're not making a ton of money, but your band is big, you end up being able to make money.
Yeah.
If you have that imprint, right? You find your way, right? I mean, if you could have
been in the Sub Pop constellation of stars.
If Sam Cooke was ripped off by his record label at another level, he's still Sam Cooke. Like, he did okay.
Right.
And the Beatles, I think, in the end, Alan Klein, bad as he was, those guys did okay. And I didn't sign with Sub Pop. I was grateful then to sign to Barsook, but I could have put an album out on Sub Pop and then worn those sweatshirts around with a feeling of ownership rather than just wearing those sweatshirts around.
Yeah, going, you still have a Sub Pop hat.
I'm pretty cool, but not that cool.
I'm more of a well-wisher.
But we're going to start with a record label called Fantasy Records, which was formed in 1949. As a small jazz imprint, and then they got their momentum, and they became kind of the signature label of Dave Brubeck.
Ah,
and Brubeck,
West Coast cool.
Yeah, Brubeck was really happening in the mid-50s.
His quartet had real chops, but they were like nice, well-behaved white boys. So a lot of college students, you know, would listen to Dave Brubeck, even if maybe they wouldn't buy a Miles Davis record.
Well, and you know, jazz at the time, I talk about it with my mom a lot because she was 21 in 1955 and worked at a radio station in the Midwest. All those early rock and roll guys came through her station, played, and she was always, you know, standing on the side of the stage holding a clipboard.
I didn't know this.
As Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis and that whole beginning of that music, and Ohio was right in the middle of the country as it remains today. And she, her attitude about it was that it was kids music and hillbilly music, and she was into jazz. Because she was 21. She wasn't 15. And it always strikes me incredible that rock and roll, from the very beginning, she felt was too young.
She's not wrong. Beatles are a boy band.
Yeah. And by the time of the Beatles, she was 27. You know, like, what? I'm not going to.
She's like, get a haircut.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, Ed Sullivan, maybe.
Exactly.
Maybe these kids should get a haircut.
Turn that stuff down. So Brubeck. And in fact, Brubeck at one point signed a record deal with Fantasy where he thought he owned half of Fantasy Records. He was a big enough deal that they were like, no, you get 50%. And he was like, 50% of the label? Absolutely. And it was only later that he realized he was getting 50% of the royalties for his albums.
What a way to find out that Dave Brubeck can't read.
You know, I think a lot of those record contracts were written on the back of a coaster.
The guy could read music in 13/4 time, but he didn't understand his own royalty structure.
So right after the war, there were a lot of guys coming back from World War II, having learned various kind of electronics and broadcasting and, you know,
that was interesting.
A lot of technology,
a nation of radio nerds. Cause they were all telling their superior that Stalin had died.
That's right. They were all,
that was everybody's job.
They understood the proximity effect of microphones. Saul Zanz had served. He was born in New Jersey in 1921, same year as my dad. And he had served in World War II, and he came back from the war and got into jazz music. He started working with a guy named Norman Granz. So Zanz and Granz and...
So it's not Norman Granz.
It might have been Granz.
Granz?
Zanz and Granz. And, you know, they met a man who had the golden Anne. But then Saul got a job at Fantasy Records in 1955, kind of key Dave Brubeck years. And Zanz has the classic bio of like started in the warehouse when there were only two guys there, and then gradually worked his way up through the label. I should go back because I was talking about jazz labels in New York and Chicago, and I kind of lumped Fantasy in with them. But in fact, Fantasy was always a California label. Okay. It started in San Francisco and was and that was their connection to Brubeck. So although the music industry was happening in these centers that we talked about, Nashville and Memphis and Chicago, this was a California enterprise. And throughout the 50s, they were kind of putting out they were part of the jazz Chet Baker kind of zone, and these labels all were interacting with each other, just as jazz was kind of spreading out and becoming a musical form that had a lot of kind of regional sounds and artists that were specific to certain areas of the country. They hired a composer that by the name of Vince Guaraldi, who you may have heard of. And Vince, by the early 60s, had started, you know, making instrumental jazz. He composed the music for the Charlie Brown
Christmas
special. And that started as an album called Jazz Impressions of a Boy Named Charlie Brown. And on that was the Linus and Lucy song that then the following year became famous. And that really put...
Which dancer are you? You got lots of options.
I'm the little girl that shakes her head from side to side. Left, right.
I think even at the time there was a lot, and still today, a lot of comment about putting that kind of a soundtrack on a cartoon Christmas special about children.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have to be wistful, slightly sexy jazz piano.
I think that that music, along with some Dave Brubecky kind of stuff that you heard used as soundtrack music when I was a kid.
Made you try marijuana for the first time.
It did, right? I mean, that was jazz. That was the first time a kid right. would hear jazz that was directed kind of at them.
Yes.
And that vibe, the vibe of Charlie Brown Christmas, there's a reason we still all love it. And that is a tune that, I mean, it's just a killer hook.
My dad used to spin a lot of Dave Brubeck records and played yeah. them on the piano. He could play pretty much all of Blue Rondo a la Turk, which is not an easy piece to play. And he was always reminding us, this is the only piece I know how to play that uses the bottom key of the piano. Bum, 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 bum. You actually use the leftmost key.
I wish that you had a piano in your house and that we would have a party where your dad played Dave Brubeck while the rest of us stood around in thin lapelled suits.
I have a little upright. It's not that good and none of us play it.
Yeah.
But it's in tune, I think.
Could you roll it, like lift it up into the living room and roll it in where your dad could...
It's actually in the living room. It's kind of behind that wall where the dining room table is.
There's a piano in your living room, and I have never sat down and...
Yeah, how come you're not gracing us with a... How come we're not all sitting around singing George M. Cohan songs every time you come over?
Is it covered with a sheet?
It has a Lego ship and a bottle over it. Okay. Did you get distracted by that?
Yeah, maybe that's why. Maybe that's why I didn't notice. So Zance was working at the company at this point, and he'd had a relationship with a lot of different jazz musicians. Fantasy actually started putting out the Lenny Bruce records.
Ah.
So, and again, San Francisco kind of centric vibe, but Zance, and this is a set the Wayback Machine 5 years earlier. Charles Mingus had started his own record label called Debut Records. As a way of releasing his own music separate from the, you know, again, an indie rock mentality.
Early for a jazz guy to be putting out his own, starting his own label.
And he started it with help from his wife, Celia, who, by all accounts, like her mother seeded the cash to start this label. And Debut Records put out a bunch of... Mingus records, including Jazz at Massey Hall. Like it had Max Roach was part of the label. It was influential, but remained small. And Mingus and Celia divorced. And then Celia went to work at Fantasy, met Zance, who was still, you know, who was not yet president of the company, but was still kind of, you know, mover and a shaker there. Still a small record company. And then Celia and Zance married.
Oh.
And Mingus.
She's white? Mingus is married to a...
She's a white lady.
White girl, okay.
You know, Charles Mingus is one quarter Chinese.
I did not, in fact, know that.
Yeah. Charles Mingus.
I don't know what to do with that information, but that's... if you had asked me how Chinese is Charles Mingus, I think I would have said 0 to 1%.
Yeah, if you look at Charles Mingus's ethnic background, it's like the story of America. Frankly,
he's a big melting pot.
He is
with behind an upright bass.
But as a wedding gift to, because obviously he and Celia remained friends, as a wedding gift, Mingus gave the Debut Records catalog to Zance and Celia as a wedding present
for his ex-wife marrying another guy at a different label.
Yeah. He was like,
Is he big hearted?
I think, I mean, everybody loves Mingus. I think he just, he'd stopped releasing records on Debut. And so it was clear what the catalog was. It's a pretty great catalog. And so, yeah, he gave him the record company as a
dowry, basically. Suddenly, yeah. Saul Zance owns a ton of Max Roach records.
And I think he said it was, you know, Celia was responsible for founding the label, and also she was kind of the business mind behind it. And so he felt like, you guys have this.
Wow.
Pretty good. And the ownership of his own label and his status there at Fantasy resulted in ultimately he becoming president of Fantasy Records in the mid to late 60s, 67. And at this point, Fantasy had done all these cool things. They were, you know, they were a viable label. Like they had a thing I've never heard of before where their mono LPs, they put out on red vinyl and their stereo LPs were on blue vinyl.
Whoa.
really cool idea for that era of like, well, we can't decide which is the format, mono or stereo, but we're gonna do this cool vibe thing.
I'm gonna put out my records in 3D. It's gonna be red on one side and blue on the other.
Yeah, man. Yeah. I don't think they do that anymore.
I've never seen old records that old on colored vinyl, I think.
Yeah, and I think all the reissues, I think they settled down. What we put out colored vinyl, like the Western State record is on yellow vinyl,
yeah.
But the consensus seems to be that black vinyl sounds better.
It sounds so yellow.
That's one of those. That's one of those like, oh, I only put half charged 9-volt batteries in my distortion pedals because it gives it a fuzzier sound.
So you don't.
That's legitimately a thing that people.
You don't actually buy it.
Well, I just put whatever battery. I put a battery in and leave it until it dies.
You don't buy this electrical music mysticism, is what I'm saying.
No, I don't. I don't. Well, I think the distinction is I don't have a guitar tech that can carry around batteries where he knows how much power is left in them.
So you aim to do that. Someday you want to be successful enough that you can be picky about your...
I pull a Tube Screamer out of a shoebox and go, God, I hope this still works. And it kind of does. And I'm like, that's good enough.
John, you know what I'm getting really into?
Anime. That's manga.
That's 100% right. I'm getting into the weirdest anime you have ever seen.
Oh, that's pretty weird then.
And I'm doing a lot of fan art for it.
Sure.
For, you know, a certain kind of connoisseur audience, if you know what I mean.
Oh, too much, I know what you mean.
And I want to start selling my art and my insightful fiction detailing some of these encounters.
Okay.
On my anime-specific blog. But I don't know much about how to set up a website. What is an anime fan like me to do?
Well, so I don't know very much. What I do know about anime and manga, it's already more than I want to know. But what I do know about...
Yeah, what is your area of expertise, if not anime?
It's setting up a website for writing, blogging, and content making, and maintaining a fan base online.
But you're not a computer programmer. How do you know so much about how to do that?
Well, here's what I do, Ken. I use Squarespace. That's right. You can create a community on your Squarespace website with a fully integrated commenting system that supports threaded comments, which, as you may or may not know, is very important if you are making anime fan fiction.
That's true, because some of those threads I'm going to have to shut down.
That's right. You can
probably for legal reasons.
You can manage them with their powerful blogging tools that allow you to categorize, share, and schedule your posts, and also fully eliminate bad actors.
How is that? How is my amazing fan art going to look on mobile? Do Squarespace sites work in browser and mobile?
All Squarespace sites are optimized for mobile. What? That's optimized, Ken.
With a capital O.
Optimized. Content automatically adjusts so your site will look great on any device, including my BlackBerry Pearl, where I still... and I cannot confirm or deny that it will work on a BlackBerry Pearl, but I'm pretty sure.
What about on my Apple Lisa? What about on my Zune?
Your Apple Lisa will absolutely be able to look at you. And I can say that with confidence because I know no one listening has an operating Apple Lisa. You want to save time cross-posting, Ken?
I do. I don't want to publish stuff to Twitter and Tumblr and Facebook and all the rest.
Well, you can because it's built right into your Squarespace site. Wow. Squarespace auto-posts your content to all of those that you just mentioned, including your personal and brand pages. And all post entries and images are optimized and tagged, so descriptions and titles will be correct wherever you are posting.
This sounds like my anime website is going to be so efficient that I might actually have time to leave the house and maybe meet real-life friends for the first time ever.
No. If you're going to properly be a weeaboo, Ken, you need to stay home and get out of the sun.
I'm going
to
be a hikikomori. I'm going to be on Squarespace 24/7.
The only places you're allowed to go that are outside of the house or compound are Comic-Cons and cosplay events. And
my furry suit will protect me.
That's only 3 times a year, even in a big city like Seattle.
I'm sold, John. I'm going to head to squarespace.com/omnibus to get a free trial of some of these amazing tools you've outlined for me.
We know what's good. What's good is when you're ready to launch, all you do is use the offer code omnibus and you'll save 10% off of your first purchase of a website or domain.
That's a screaming deal.
So thank you, Squarespace, for supporting Omnibus and the Omnibus Project. At this point, fantasy is doing really well. Jazz Impressions of a Boy Named Charlie Brown is selling big dollars. And they're a San Francisco label, and they have a kid working in the warehouse by the name of John Fogerty.
he's packing records or something?
Yeah. I mean, you know, he's young. Fogerty is, this is the boomer content that everybody's been waiting for.
Boomer ears picked up everywhere. Did you say John Fogerty? And he's driving a forklift?
John Fogerty? Fogerty was 20 years old in 1965. And he and his brother, Tom, had put together a band. You know, Tom was older and was the kind of original singer guy. Fogerty and his buddies from high school, they're all from Berkeley. They're all from a pretty nice neighborhood, El Cerrito, outside of Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And were, you know, just white kids trying to play sock hops.
So he already had a band by the time he was...
Well, yeah, and Creedence, before it was Creedence, was... It had all the same sort of names that you would expect from a high school band at the time.
Oh, I don't know these.
They were called, well, for a while they were called the Gollywogs.
Ooh, that's not good.
No, that was an attempt, I think, to make them sound like a British invasion band.
Yeah, but it today and, you know, then as now, that's actually a racist caricature in Britain.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Oh.
A gollywog is a little blackface cartoon character. Or
gollywog. Well, so,
yeah, a lot of people threw out their gollywogs around sometime in the 70s.
It
does make them sound like a British invasion band, though.
Yeah, and I think the Fogerty brothers knew better than that and did not adopt the gollywogs for long. They had other names like Johnny Fogerty and the Blue Lagoons or whatever, you know, all that.
Yeah, all that stuff. Like Beatles era, Johnny and the Moondogs. It's probably one dance they played.
Yeah, and I think it was one of the Weiss brothers that suggested the Gollywogs because Fogerty was trying to get on Fantasy Records from his, you know, from his position as like a kid working at the shop.
Yeah.
And it was only when Zantz took over as president and then Zantz put it together and actually bought the label from the Weiss brothers. It was Zantz that said, why don't we find a better name for your band? And they came up with Creedence Clearwater Revival. And that's a name that actually has a Northwest connection.
Is that right?
Creedence was the name of a girl that they knew.
Do you think it was spelled like that? Because it's got an extra E.
Well, the girl, the Creedence part has nothing to do with the Northwest, but Clearwater came from an Olympia beer commercial. They were
really?
All sitting around and they were like, it's the water.
Wait, were there there were national Olympia beer commercials
in
huh?
the 60s, I guess they were.
They could have been named after artesians.
Yeah, that's right. The Creedence Artesian Revival. It actually sounds just as good.
It does.
And the revival thing was because those guys were, they weren't like opposed. They weren't conservative and opposed to the hippies so much as they felt like all that hippie stuff was irrelevant, kind of extraneous to rock and roll. They were coming from a place where they really liked the roots.
Yeah.
It's hard to think now that in 1965 you could be a snob about roots music, but they absolutely were.
The West Coast has ruined rock.
Yeah, like,
I'm going back to the bayou.
All this long reverb, you know, what you want is short reverb. Like, these were all arguments that I had in the 80s and 90s, but they were having them in the mid-60s. And Creedence had a real working class, they had working class affectations, and famously, Southern roots music affectations at a time when...
I think the whole time I grew up listening to them and not actually, this is terrible, not actually liking them, I thought they were a Southern band. I thought they were Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Everybody did, including people from the South. you know, the guys that the Muscle Shoals guys all loved Creedence, and then when they found out they were from Berkeley, were like
what?
Infuriated.
You've never been down on a corner.
And when Creedence first toured in the South, they were afraid that they were going to get picketed or beat up, and were greatly relieved and thrilled that they were huge in the South. Creedence had that incredible, and you know, I know you don't like them, which is weird.
It's a little weird
because they're great, but they had they adopted, you know, real voodoo chillin' lyrics and vibe. Really, really, a complete put on. When I first realized they weren't from the South, somebody told me they were from Los Angeles, and I thought, well, that's maybe consistent with Los Angeles.
Well, but, yeah, people there are from nowhere, so.
But to think that Creedence was coming up in the Bay Area at the same time of that Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead and all the whole Bay Area music scene was happening just across the bridge, and
I can't tell if I should like them more now that I found out they were able to do this amazing pastiche of a whole different music scene, or if this just confirms my idea that there's something deeply uncomfortable and artificial about them.
What's funny is that during the grunge years here, when Neil Young was kind of adopted by all the grunge bands as their spiritual forefather,
yeah,
and that's because Neil's crusty and loud.
And Canadian.
And Canadian.
We're virtually Canadian here.
But honestly, the spiritual forefather of all of Seattle rock was Creedence, in the sense that it was, I mean, there's nobody crustier than John Fogerty, as we'll see in a minute. But also, the sound of Creedence is kind of more grunge than grunge, in a way. I've had this discussion around in smoky bars a lot, and it's been a long time since I've been in a smoky bar, and I don't remember
exactly
what my argument was.
I've never had this conversation sober.
I remember spilling pitchers of beer on other people going, no, it's Creedence. It should have been Creedence the whole time.
I can see it depending on the band. I mean, because grunge was such a spectrum, all the way from these punk-influenced bands all the way over to...
I feel like if you... And I think maybe I was making the argument that Mudhoney and Creedence...
Yeah.
Mudhoney had more to, owed way more to Creedence than they did had anything to do with Neil Young.
I think Mudhoney is the Creedence-iest grunge band.
Yeah. And then it's... Pearl Jam, sure. I mean, you know, that's a different story.
See LA again.
And so it was really Saul Zance that facilitated the Creedence, you know, the universe of Creedence.
I had no idea.
And Creedence came out, their first single was Suzy Q, which was a cover. And it was an immediate hit. They never had a single that was a cover song after that.
Huh.
All the songs were written by John Fogerty in this style of, I mean, he's sitting in his apartment in Berkeley, California, staring at a wall, imagining himself on a riverboat queen.
And he's so convincing that Tina Turner covers him.
Yeah, that's right. And his music immediately becomes massively popular. And I don't think that people can quite appreciate how big Creedence was. Creedence had 14 consecutive top 10 singles between 1969 and 1971.
My favorite trivia fact is they were kept out of the number one slot each time. They have five Billboard number two singles, never made it to the top of the pop chart.
And the reason was, at that moment, it was that the apogee of bubblegum pop. Mm. So they were kept out of the top slot by the Archies.
I was going to say, is it Sugar Sugar?
Sugar Sugar kept them out. Dizzy kept them out. They were, and this was right in the period where the Beatles were still the biggest band in the world, but then the Beatles were gone. And arguably at that moment, Creedence was the biggest band in the world.
Do you think they celebrated the day they read the Apple Records press release?
Well, we all did.
High five and woo!
Thank God they're gone. Creedence had five, and that's 14 consecutive top 10 singles, right? Wow. Every single they released went into the top 10. Five consecutive top 10 records in the space of 2 years. Like, they're releasing in sometimes three records a year. Somehow Fogerty got it into his mind that if they ever weren't on the charts, they would never get back on the charts.
That we would die.
So we had to keep, you know, they had to keep their songs in the top 10, or
they're like sharks. They got to keep swimming. He's got a notebook that just has words like moon, bayou, riverboat. He's like feverishly like, ah.
And he signed a contract for the band signed a contract with Zance and Fantasy Records that has been talked about in the music business for 1,000 years, mostly because of John Fogerty's retconning of it. But it was a terrible contract, like all bad contracts. You know, like the one that I signed with Sub Pop that had, or I'm sorry, the one that I
could have signed
with Sub Pop that had some clause in it that, like, well, you know, records fall off the back of a truck and we're not responsible for those.
You pay
us. At a time when nobody was making, there was no vinyl anymore, you know. That's right, you pay us. But it was a standard bad contract. It wasn't remarkably bad.
But he mythologizes himself as now somebody who was exploited?
Well, what happened was the band became so big, and there was a power struggle within the band. Tom was the older brother. John had become the mastermind. He was writing all the songs. He was producing all the records. He was playing all the overdubs. The other guys would come in, and they rehearsed so exhaustively that they could go in and record an album in 3 days. But then as the albums got more and more produced, it was always Fogerty in there in the middle of the night playing the tambourine, which is normal. That's true for a lot of records that I can think of. You've got one guy that's got a vision. But there are issues, right? The bass player does want to be more involved. Creedence was one of the headliners of Woodstock, but nobody knows it because Fogerty felt like their performance wasn't that great, and so he kept Creedence off out of the movie and off of the Woodstock album.
Yeah, they're not in the movie.
So nobody thinks about Creedence as being like one of the big headliners.
Sha-na-na blew him off the stage.
Fogerty blames it on the Dead. Because the Dead played
before
them. We found
a band I'm less into than CCR.
The Dead played before CCR, and Fogerty claims put the whole audience to sleep. He came out on the stage, and everybody was just sprawling in the mud, like stoned. And he was like, no, 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 our performance wasn't good enough. Although, by all accounts, it was great. Huh. But they encountered what are normal band problems. Fogerty became a little bit of a dictator. The guys in the band pushed back. And
is he the younger brother or the older brother?
He's the younger brother. John is the younger
brother.
This is
now a biblical story.
And up until that point, everybody that worked with them felt like they were doing it exactly right. I mean, they had made all this incredible music in such a short amount of time, and they were wildly popular across the country. Right, like they were somehow, although they put out a lot of anti-war music, it appealed to soldiers in Vietnam. It appealed to people in the South. Like "Fortunate Son" is an incredible anti-war anthem, but it's popular with everybody. It's not perceived as
political as a Jefferson Airplane song.
Yeah, everybody agrees that rich kids don't get drafted. That there's the only people that are mad about that are senators' sons. And even they probably were like, that's a pretty good record. Like Creedence was hugely popular in the army in Vietnam.
Well, no one likes anti-war songs more than a soldier in Vietnam.
Right. But also you would, you know, those were the, I'm Just an Okie from Muskogee guys too, who it was a band that appealed to everybody. And, you know, if you think about it, there's not a helicopter that landed in Vietnam without Fortunate Son playing in the
That's
background.
That's what the movies have told me. You know? Do you think it's a Southern accent? Like, it's the Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton thing? Like, we just need to put a Southern accent on our liberals, then we can put this over.
When I listen to Creedence, I don't hear him putting on a fake accent. I mean, San Francisco is famous for putting on fake accents. All of the Green Day, like, fake British accent stuff that came later. But I hear Fogerty just singing in his own voice. It's just that. It's just the sound, the incredible sound of what are extremely simple arrangements and simple parts.
Is he a great guitarist? I don't even know this.
What they are is great craftsmen. Fogerty never, I mean, if you think about all of his kind of parts, no, they're not. There's nothing virtuosic.
Yeah, I think so.
That's the word? Virtuosic?
I apologize.
I've never said that once before in my life.
You don't have to say it again.
Virtuosic. I'm going to say it. There's nothing especially virtuosic about any of their playing, except it's like AC/DC. The band is so smooth and it has a sound. And I should say Angus Young is an incredibly virtuosic guitar player.
Look at you. You're a pro of virtuosic all
of a sudden. Yeah, virtuosic.
It's like you were born saying it.
It really feels like it needs a T. Virtuosic.
It has one just earlier.
Oh. Virtuosic.
Do you want to move that T around? Virtuosic.
Virtuostical. So the band fell apart. Tom left feeling like he, and this is the other problem with being huge. Everybody in the band feels like they're a genius.
I'll have my own band.
Tom left to start his own band. They carried on as a three-piece, and the hilarious conflict at this point was that the other guys wanted, they felt like Zance and John Fogerty, that Fogerty kept signing, that they should have renegotiated and could have renegotiated, and Zance was ready to renegotiate, and John Fogerty didn't want to, or he resisted it because he was the manager of the band. He was in charge. The accounts at the time say that although they were the biggest band in the world, like their tour operation was just like two old friends of theirs and like a guy that that was in charge of beer, and John Fogerty was doing all the work.
He's selling merch.
Yeah. And they weren't into drugs. They weren't, you know, they were like still a family operation and kind of seen as pretty unhip by the cool guitar solo scene that if you think about 1971 and rock and roll, you don't even really see credence in that. They were so kind of other. But so the other guys and the bass player, Stu Cook, actually had a degree in business. But Fogerty,
like many bassists, he had an advanced degree.
Fogerty wouldn't agree to hire a business manager. And so the other guys in the band are like, he's throwing millions away. We're losing millions. And so
you're not blaming Saul Zance because he's our title character.
I'm not blaming Saul Zance. And Saul Zance gets cast in that role. And in the 1980s, got cast in that role of like the ultimate bad dude, bad deal record guy. But really, it seems like John Fogerty had such a obsessive grip over the band that he wasn't capable of listening to reason. And ultimately, and accounts differ. John Fogerty says that the other two guys, Stu Cook, the bass player, and Doug Clifford, the drummer, came to him and said, "We want to make a record where we sing, each of us writes and sings one third of the record. So you're going to do three songs, and Stu's going to do three songs, and Doug's going to do three songs."
This happened at the end of the Beatles. There was a moment where they were like, "What if we?" You know, when they re-upped with EMI not announcing that they were going to, or Capitol not announcing that they were going to, that they had already maybe decided to break up. They had some deal where like everybody does four songs, including Ringo. This is how it's going to be. And it almost happened.
And it seems if you only got your information through John Fogerty, it seems like, oh, wow, that's the rock excess rearing its ugly head. And here they've had all these hit records with one guy. And now the drummer thinks he wants to do three songs.
A quarter of the record.
But if you talk to Stu and Doug, they say, no, what happened was Fogerty was so pissed that we were challenging his authority on the business side that he said, oh, you guys think you know everything? Well, on the next record, we're going to split the songwriting three ways and let's see how you do.
Oh, wow. And so it's not actually the... This is the olive branch that I think keeps the band Sloan together. Well, beloved Canadian power pop band Sloan is always like, the drummer gets a quarter of the record, no matter what.
And that happens in a lot of bands, right? That's true of the Presidents of the USA, right? They split the money three ways. That was true of Nirvana until they got famous and Kurt said, actually, no, I'm going to take 70% of the royalties.
Oops.
But this wasn't so much about royalties as it was, according to Stu and Doug, and it's hard to imagine, but also kind of not, this was Fogerty being willing to embarrass them, willing to put out a bad record.
A bad CCR record.
In order to put them in their place.
See, and we'll never try that again.
And I think if you were Stu Cook and...
Is he gonna drag his ass on their songs?
That's what happened. Apparently, Clifford said at one point, like, could you like help me with this tune and make it sound more Creedence? Fogerty was like, you're on your own. These are your three songs. And I think you could imagine in 1971, these guys going, I guess I get to get three songs. I mean, they probably weren't fighting exactly.
Yeah.
But according to them, the idea was John's and he forced the issue. And that record came out, it was called Mardi Gras, and it was, although immediately went to number 12 and was a gold record, it was universally panned, pretty, I think, called the worst rock album that John Landau had ever heard.
I'm ready for the hot takes. I'm ready for Mardi Gras to be reappraised.
Well, you may get your chance. I don't know. At that point, the band broke up acrimoniously. Mm. Fogerty went and tried to record a solo album, but because he had never actually successfully renegotiated his contract with Saul Zantz, at the time of the dissolution of Creedence, he owed eight more albums to Fantasy Records. And so was kind of contractually on the hook until David Geffen, and you can see the logic behind this. Geffen said, this guy's written, he wrote all this genius music in such a short amount of time. I'm going to sign him to my own, you know, Geffen made a lot of good business deals. He made some bad ones too. He paid $1 million to get Fogerty out of his record
contract. Buys him out.
And Fogerty put out one record on a Geffen label and didn't really do much traffic.
Yeah, did he not have much of a solo career? I can't think of
one. Well, we'll get to that in a second. Okay. Fogerty was so bitter about the breakup of the band and gradually, and Saul Zantz took a lot of Creedence money and put it in some questionable financial deals in Central America and lost a lot of money on the, you know, lost a lot of quote unquote Creedence's money. But Fogerty eventually like turned against Zantz and saw the bad record deal as the source of his acrimony. And you would think that the guys in the band that had been arguing for a renegotiation with Zantz would have been bitter towards Zantz. But in fact, they were allied with him. And Zantz made a lot of record industry promises about like, oh, we'll work this all out. We'll work it out in the wash. But it was John Fogerty, that stood because he had made so many bad decisions, then needing to live with those decisions, he displaced that blame onto Zantz. And in 1980, he was, again, Geffen had bought him out of his record contract, but he was still under, Fogerty still had obligations to Fantasy Records. Like unmet obligations as, you know, a component of the songwriting side of the label. And in 1980, in order to get out of that obligation, he transferred a bunch of rights to his own songs over to Zantz. Again,
His Creedence era song?
Yeah. A really bad decision.
Not something you would do if that guy were the evil exploiter of your artistic purity.
Right. And at that point, Fogerty stopped being willing to play Creedence music because
he'd be making
money for the man. And so all through the 80s, refused to play, kind of went dark for a while, refusing to play Creedence song. In 1985, he reappeared and put out an album called Center Field.
The only solo song of his I know. It's basically a novelty song about baseball.
But that was a huge album. Sold a lot of records. And actually had a couple of hits on it. But
I'm looking. Rock and Roll Girls. So he toured.
He toured and Center Field was a really big smash.
Yeah, he can retire on Major League Baseball stadium playings of that song alone, probably.
He toured, but in all of those big tour, refused to play Creedence songs. Because it was in all the newspapers about it, because there was a song on the record called Zance Can't Dance, which was just a slur against Saul Zance. And another song on that record called Mr. Greed, also about him. And the two of them then, Zance and John Fogerty, proceeded to sue one another multiple times. And most famously, Zance sued Fogerty because his another hit on that was The Old Man Down the Road.
Oh, yeah.
Which had a really, like, a fun music video. It sounded very Creedence-y. So Creedence-y, in fact, that Zance claimed that Fogerty was plagiarizing his own music. And because Zance owned the rights to the Creedence songs,
he's not allowed to sound like
he's
himself.
He's not allowed to cover himself. So Zance claims
a little legally iffy. I know we're supposed to be pro Zance in this podcast, but my Zance stance has kind of weakened.
I can't say whether Zance can dance, and I'm not going to criticize your Zance stance, but he's claiming that Run Through the Jungle has the same melody and vibe as Old Man Down the Road. And at the time in the 80s, we were all against Zance because that seemed like such a, let's be honest, dick move.
Keep a guy from using his own style.
Yeah, to sue a guy. And Fogerty was in all the newspapers as a guy that's like, I'm prevented from playing Creedence records by this, or tunes, by this evil record dude. Zance lost that case because Fogerty actually got up on the stand with a guitar and played each song and was like, they're not the same song.
That's how all court cases should be.
Yeah.
You should be settled.
You should
imagine a Perry Mason like TV show that always ends not with somebody confessing from the stand, but a guitar solo.
I wish that I could have resolved my legal disputes with my neighbors by getting up on the stand with a guitar and like, listen, let me break this down for you. Bow down, no, no, no.
Marvin or Chuck, it's your cousin Marvin Berry. Listen to this testimony.
Play blues in A. Follow me for the changes. Eventually, and I've made this a lot about Creedence because the Fogerty stance throughout this is something that I refer to a lot in my own life, because it's an example of a person who had it all. And I don't mean it all in terms of money, power, but creatively had it all, had made, although you don't like it, a block of music that's just inarguably part of the American song.
I don't love it, but I could sing, I could sing 15 Creedence songs.
That's right.
Think how much you would like them if you liked them.
We all know them all, right? Yeah. They had more singles than the Eagles. So he had achieved what any artist would dream of. And yet, because of bitterness around money and control of a band that he was in complete control over, he spent 20 years unable or unwilling to play his own music.
And it's easy to mistake that for principle.
Yeah. And he presents it as principle. If you look at the induction of Creedence into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, on that day, Doug Clifford and Stu Cook showed up to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and found that, prepared to have a reunion.
They assumed Fogarty was coming.
Fogarty did come and had arranged that all of the Creedence music would be played with an all-star band, including Robbie Robertson and Bruce Springsteen. Mm-hmm. And Doug and Stu, not invited to, although they're being inducted.
Because the band typically plays. They assumed they were going to all play together for the first time in a decade or whatever it was.
And if you think, well, yeah, more than that.
Oh, yeah. When were they inducted? Early 90s?
Early 90s.
Yeah.
If you think about, you know, the kind of bitterness that would make a man keep his own bandmates out of their Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction.
So Fogarty sang, backed by
Bruce Springsteen. The band actually, Creedence got together two times from 1972 to the present. One of them was at Brother Tom's wedding in 1980, mm-hmm. When things had not soured so badly. And then one of them was at their 20-year high school reunion.
Oh, interestingly.
They all went.
I thought you were going to say 9/11 or something.
They all went and they jumped up on stage and played some kicker music.
You
for
always
their
hear
high
about these
buddies.
Things. I guess it's just a testament to the power of alcohol.
Yeah, right.
Like,
no
matter how much we hated each other.
You're there at the 20-year reunion and there's that girl you always wanted to impress and you get to get up and like play your tunes. And Tom actually got AIDS through a blood transfusion in the mid-80s and died.
I didn't know that.
And the other two guys, Doug and Stu, started a band called Creedence Clearwater Revisited in 1995 after this humiliation at the Rock Hall of Fame.
Did he sue?
He did. Yeah. And then they kind of won the suit, and they're still tour. They're kind of like Ringo Starr's all-star band.
Do they have some sound-alike lead singer like that Filipino guy in Journey?
I think they get like different people to get up and do the tunes.
Yeah, the Ringo thing. The Ringo thingo.
But to go back to the titular star of our show here at the...
I feel like he's not getting as much star treatment as John Fogarty.
For the last few minutes of this show, because we're at our hour line and we're going to wrap it up now. Zance... And this was all part of Fogarty's story that Zance was unscrupulous and had robbed him and cheated him. But everyone else that's ever dealt with Zance has pretty good things to say about him, starting with Michael Douglas, the actor.
Oh, yeah.
Michael Douglas and Zance went to a stage production of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and liked it so much that he bought the company. No,
he bought the rights.
He liked it so much that he bought the film rights.
And this is his first dipping his toe into showbiz?
Yeah. Or this
or
side
non-music,
of showbiz.
Non-music.
And in conjunction with a very young Michael Douglas.
Yeah, bearded Michael Douglas.
As co-producer.
Pre-China syndrome.
Produced the 1975 film, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Michael Douglas had an Oscar for that, like over a decade before he had one for acting.
Yeah, right. And Saul Zance wins the Best Picture Oscar as producer in conjunction with Mike Douglas. They both get a Best Picture Oscar. But One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest swept the Oscars.
Actor. It's that and Silence of the Lambs, I think, might be the only movies to do all the top five.
All the top five. Yeah. And so Zance then...
It happened one night, maybe. I don't know.
Uses... And now we're crossing over again into Beatles territory. He took the money that he made from the Creedence albums.
Exploitation.
And bought the rights to the film rights and I think all sort of associated rights to the Lord of the Rings trilogy from the Tolkien. Actually, he bought it from Universal. Universal bought it from Tolkien. And then Universal was like, no one's ever going to make a good movie out of these Lord of the Rings films. We're going to focus on what were the big Universal? Oh, that Universal comes back into the picture.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wait, so this was, did he own the rights no, I guess he wouldn't have owned the rights yet at the time the Beatles were circling it.
No, right after.
Okay. So maybe he didn't come up in our previous omnibus entry about Lord of the Rings adapting.
But he did own the rights and was responsible for the Ralph Bakshi animated Lord of the Rings film in the 70s. And then he went on to produce Amadeus.
Ah, Amadeus. That makes sense.
1984.
That makes sense because Milos Forman directed both Cuckoo's Nest and
that's it.
Amadeus.
Won the Best Picture Oscar again as producer in 84. And then in 1996, bought an unpublished novel called The English Patient, which he adapted to film and won a third Best Picture Oscar for producing The English Patient.
He has an amazing hit rate.
He does. He also produced Mosquito Coast.
Are there a bunch of bad movies? Oh, I like Mosquito Coast.
The Unbearable Lightness of Being.
I love that movie.
And his final film was Goya's Ghosts, which I've been meaning to watch because I'm a big fan of Goya.
And Ghosts. You believe in Goya? You believe in Ghosts?
I do. I do.
That's another Milos Forman joint. I have not seen it.
And at some point he spun off his... he spun off into a different company, what he called Middle Earth Enterprises. And Middle Earth Enterprises is the production company responsible for all of the Lord of the Rings films.
Yeah, he still has some kind of EP credit on the Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings films, even though he had nothing to do with the production.
Right, but owned the rights, so
yep.
So profited from the $1 billion.
Is he making like little lead figurines of hobbits for specialty stores?
So if you think about the rights, the overwhelming family of rights
around... Video games, tabletop gaming.
And they did... This was part of the... there were all these disputes with the Tolkien family over the decades because those early contracts didn't include the... You know, did include the rights to games, but didn't include the rights to cosplay ears or, you know, like there's so much money to be made that there was there. And I think still there's a lot of dispute over who has the, and the problem with The Hobbit was that when Universal bought the rights from Tolkien, the Tolkien estate kept some adaptation rights to The Hobbit because they assumed that, well, you had to make The Hobbit first.
Right.
So we're going to retain, you know, some rights to The Hobbit because, and we'll sell the LOTR stuff.
Those deals get so messy because there's characters that are shared and.
Right. And so when it came time then to retroactively make The Hobbit films after the fact, the deals were a lot different. But it got weird in the 2000s, Middle Earth Enterprises, the Saul Zantz Corporation, actually started suing like little pubs in England that were called the Hobbit Hole. Like they were so crazy about trying to enforce their copyright.
Aggressive IP enforcement.
Yeah, that in order to keep companies from calling themselves like Hobbit Gaming Corp, they also went after all these. They made Stephen Fry mad because they were yelling at his local
pub. Oh, is that right?
Pub,
he drank at a place called,
The Hobbit's Nose or whatever.
Well, I mean, you know, Disney goes after daycares that have Winnie the Pooh on the wall. And my family of IP lawyers is always like, no, Disney has to do that, you know, because later on, if they don't, it could actually be used as an argument against them in court that they have not been robustly defending the Winnie the Pooh copyright in these 10 cases they declined to pursue. And therefore, of course, the defendant made his Winnie the Pooh themed pornography.
Yeah, exactly. I love that stuff, by the way. Winnie the Pooh themed pornography.
Can't get enough of it. Like, my fetish is a bear with his no pants on and his head in a honey jar.
I really hope nobody ever looks at my browser history. Anyway, Zantz lived to the ripe old age of 2014.
Wow, that is quite old.
He was
twice as old as Methuselah.
No, he was 92 when he died.
Oh, wow.
Unfortunately, of Alzheimer's related complications. Mm. But, considering where he started, his three Best Picture Oscars and like basically ownership of Credence.
He owned Credence and Lord of the Rings. He owned like a huge segment of Boomer America's soul.
He did. What's funny is that eventually he sold Fantasy Records to a company that was being helmed by Norman Lear.
Huh.
And
Norman Lear bought a record company
as a gesture of goodwill, agreed to pay the guys in Credence like a fair royalty rate.
I love to imagine Norman Lear as this 100-year-old saintly figure who just dives into all these great rivalries and is like, hey, Betty Davis and Joan Crawford, you guys should hang out more.
So anyway, I bought you guys a house together.
Paul McCartney and Yoko Ono, you guys are going on vacation.
But Fogerty immediately re-signed with Fantasy Records just to like stick it in his ear, I guess. And Fantasy continued to put out weird, I mean, they're like the Tedeschi and Trux label for three of their big albums.
Is it still around?
No, it folded not that long ago, before the pandemic, but not much before. But Fogerty's been doing a kind of publicity tour over the last few years, saying that he's put it all behind him. There's no bitterness left. He's he realizes his mistakes and he wishes everyone the best. Cook and
does he want to play with Stu and Doug again?
He has said that he's willing to play with Stu and Doug, but when asked, both Stu and Doug say, "Yeah, he hasn't called."
Yeah,
and screw that guy, basically.
I mean, that's what happened to David Crosby by the time he was doing his apology tour. It was too late. Everybody hated him.
Well, he despite being through with the bitterness and having resolved it all and having a clear heart, when Saul Zance died in 2015 or 2014, Fogerty's only comment was to post on his Facebook page a link to Zance Can't Dance.
Well, truer now than ever, I guess. And that concludes Saul Zance. Entry number 1455.1S1435, certificate number 42240 in the omnibus. Now, futurelings, we were products of our time. We weren't using social media to dance on the graves of our business rivals. But it was normal to us. We didn't know it was wrong. We were at Omnibus Project, at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick, pretty much minus just to keep up with my spelling bee scores at this point.
Mm-hmm. That's the only reason you subscribe to the New York Times?
I actually don't. I have a separate subscription to their games thing.
Oh, why not just go the whole distance so you can read the articles?
I don't love the Times lately.
Oh, it's because of their conservative take?
Just their aggressively centrist take. And then not just that, but then the wagon circling after every misstep, you know. Yeah, we don't have a public editor now. We just yell at our critics because we can. We're the New York Times. Do you know how big their subscriber base has grown?
No.
They're doing great.
Really?
But it's at the expense of all the other papers. You know, it used to be that if you were a respectable person in an American city, you would get
your local paper and the New York
Times. The Tribune or the Examiner or whatever. And now all these people just get the New York Times because the local papers are desiccated. And then it's a feedback circle so what do you call it? A circle of death that makes them worse.
Oh, the circle of death.
That's not right. Vicious circle. I think that's the term. But you could also email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Express your anger that I do not emotionally respond to the hard-driving swamp rock of John Fogerty at all. Send physical objects.
Send us all your Credence tour memorabilia.
I will wear it ironically. To P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Here's a note from MJ. Dear Ken and John, it's a postcard. Water towers are cool. And then it shows a very cool water tower, like a scale model. You could actually, it looks like if you had a really fine X-Acto knife, you could construct it from this from this postcard. But then he says, not this one in particular, just in general. Even though he has sent us, look at this, a pretty cool water tower, he then disavows it, or they just disavow it in the note.
Well, look at that.
I think it's a beautiful water tower. You don't have to feel bad about your postcard, MJ. I thought it was great.
No, that's, I could see that. What you could do is copy this, blow it up, and then give it to an 8-year-old with one of those 3D copiers.
Yep.
And tell the 8-year-old to build it and probably be nicer than the original.
If you blew it up big enough, you could tell the city of Chicago to actually build a life-size water tower out of it. But you'd have to make it much, much bigger. Futurelings congregate on Facebook and possibly Reddit and Discord and elsewhere. Are they on 4chan, John?
Well,
you are. How come you're not drawing them to you?
First of all, I try really hard not to be on 4chan. Second of all, I'm really embarrassed that I ever admitted I was on 4chan.
What does Pepe the Frog think about Omnibus?
I'm not sure Pepe himself has any thoughts.
He's not weighed in.
Pepe, wasn't he a cartoon character drawn by a nice man?
Yeah, he was good.
Who was like...
He was like Ziggy.
This is just my funny little frog. And then all of the QAnoners decided he looked good on a t-shirt.
It should have been Ziggy.
I don't have a ton of opinions about it there. And I don't think they talk very much about Omnibus.
Okay, stay away. Stay away from any multiple of four followed by the word Chan.
Or eight. Don't go to 8chan
either.
That's
what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I see. Multiples of four.
Avoid them all. If someday science is able to cobble together a 12chan, don't go there either.
I feel like one of the things that defines 4chan is that everything on there seems like it's put there by a 13-year-old.
Mm.
But then every once in a while, there's a thread that's like, hey, everybody chime in. How old are you? And where do you live? And what do you do? And everybody that chimes in is 45. So
Reddit's the opposite. And Reddit, you think you're talking to a grown-up. And then you realize, oh, this kid's in middle school. Why am I yelling about his bad Better Call Saul takes?
It's weird that Reddit and 4chan can be opposite sides of a hemisphere, and they're both awful. Like
there's so many ways to be awful.
It's like a terrible planet, and they hate each other.
America has really excelled in recent decades at just innovating new ways to be awful that the world had not.
Yeah.
Previously seen.
Thankfully, Omnibus remains pure of heart.
The Facebook page certainly seems to.
They're nice there.
You thought about it. You were like,
No, I mean, they're good.
Mean one there is me, honestly. I'm the only cranky old man down the road on
You do go the in there sometimes website. And discipline people.
Listen,
and I think it's good.
Buddy.
I think it's important.
Do you think they crave structure?
They crave you coming in and yelling at them. Because when you do, everybody's like very chastened and it gets quiet for a while, but you can tell that they're all like,
all I want is anybody to Google before they correct us. Because we're wrong all the time. It's very easy to correct us.
That's not true.
But I feel like we get corrected all the time by people who are just going off vibes. I'm not actually going to check in the dictionary to see if you could say this word three ways.
Yeah, you do.
I just don't like the way Ken or John said it.
You do the let me Google that for you, except you don't even say it.
You're like, have you ever seen the link that someone created
Googling.
Where it actually will it'll drag the mouse over to? You've seen that?
Yeah, I have.
LMEGYF or whatever.
I've seen every online diss.
The best way to support, if you feel chastened by some interaction that happened in some
omnibus. Did you put a T in the word chastened?
I took the one from Virtuositic, taking the letter T from his varsity sweater. The way to atone is to go to the Patreon page, patreon.com/omnibusproject, and either become a supporter or triple your support.
Triple your support. Today's the day.
Do you feel bad about yourself today? Triple your support to Omnibus, and you will feel like you have brought some good to the world.
It's triple your support day here at Omnibus.
There is no perk that we promise in return, but you get to triple your support.
Although I do notice people that have supported Omnibus Patreon do feel like the perk is that they can reach out to me day or night, 24/7, and remind me.
Do they subscribe?
Hey, I'm a longtime subscriber, so please leave a phone message for my sick uncle.
I almost think that things will go better for you in every area of your life if you become an Omnibus supporter.
I mean, that is a perk. You can call me day or night.
You will find the parking meter you pull up at has hours to go.
Is that still a thing? I think you have to live somewhere outside of Kansas City for there still to be parking meters.
LA still has them. LA still has meters that will blink.
Really?
Yeah, it's old timey. We all live in our super cities where an app parks you. But if you have never supported the Omnibus via our Patreon, there are almost 40 new shows awaiting your perusal behind the scary paywall at patreon.com/omnibusproject. Which can be breached for a pittance, John.
Just a pittance.
A pittance. A mere pittance.
A mere pittance. A monthly stipend.
The smallest kind of pittance, which would be mere.
Mere.
A sparse pittance. No?
I think you're going to get somebody correcting you on the internet. A pittance can't be sparse.
All pittances are by definition sparse, or sparse only is a frequency and a density?
Yeah, that's right. Sparse is a frequency and a density. No.
Pittances would have
you,
a size. A
you measly, are my density.
A measly pittance.
A measly pittance. That's
even
precisely.
A measly, if you feel you can afford a measly amount of money, that will bring forth just untold wealth in terms of new Omnibus content. Were you to go right now to patreon.com/omnibuspro.
Although this episode has exceeded an hour,
dragged on a
considerably, I feel like the people that want out of the shows earlier could just skip the whole exegesis about the word pittance. And
should we have our editor take it out?
No. I think it's good. I think there are
they
people,
have to know it's coming and know how long it will be and skip it.
I think people that want the show to be an hour long.
They can
get out of it at an hour.
We have made an hour-long show, and then there were bonus minutes. Somebody emailed us this month to say that they always opt out of the outro because the music stresses them out.
Oh, yeah.
The show has a very relaxing vibe, and then suddenly, what is happening now? And they get very anxious, and they bail. They're not hearing me call them out right now, in fact.
For a long time, people were bragging about how they listened to all their podcasts at 2x speed or greater. And people have stopped doing that,
because
at least bragging about it.
Because it was putting them in the hospital.
But there are still people that are like, Omnibus is too long. It's longer than my drive home from work, and that makes me mad.
Well, you drive home from work 5x a week, and we don't do the show 5x a week, much though we'd love to.
Well, yeah, but they're going back and listening to our 500 back catalog.
We pre-edit the show to 2x speed. We have other shows don't do this. We have already gone in and pulled out the half the extraneous material and sped up the rest, so that what you're getting is a 2x show just out of our mouths and brains.
Ken actually has a voice that sounds like Barry White.
I haven't sped up.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we had no idea how long this show would be, and we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray and hoped and prayed that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes or came soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.